Hello and welcome to the inaugural edition of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm Kevin Pelton, one of your co-hosts here, a NBA analyst for ESPN Insider and Seattle sports fan, and with me is my brother Tristan.
And that's Tristan Caracino, not to be confused. I started as a Pelton and then became a Caracino when I was older. That sounds really weird. But anyway, Tristan Caracino. Nay, Pelton.
The important thing to note is he did not take his wife's name, as much as it seems like that happened.
It's very important to make that distinction. But anyway, I am the talent buyer at the Vera Project, and all I do is art and music venue. So I work in music during the day, but I'm very interested in sports, fantasy football in particular, but real football also. So anyway, we're going to be talking about Seattle sports, culture, things like that, mostly focus on Seattle, but then also fantasy football in the more general sense. We won't be talking about interesting TV programs because Kevin here does not watch any interesting TV programs.
Well, that depends on your definition of interesting.
Franklin and Bash. There might be a Franklin and Bash update every now and then. Is Franklin Bash still on?
The season is over. There was a big cliffhanger at the end.
When did it end? When did it end?
Early August.
It's too bad that we weren't recording this to talk about the Franklin and Bash, the Franklin and Bash finale. I feel like special guests for the Franklin and Bash conversation because I refuse to watch that show ever in my entire life. But we will not be talking about Breaking Bad because Kevin has no interest in watching serialized television except for Franklin and Bash.
Or dramas, yes.
Anything interesting whatsoever.
So we're going to be recording this weekly is the plan, and the other thing you didn't mention, tailgating. I think just anything around sports culture and, you know, what goes on a week-to-week basis. So that's kind of what you can expect from this podcast.
Tailgating, fancy beers, if we come upon them, burgers, rankings of vegetables, rankings of fruits, rankings of anything we possibly can rank. And have feelings about.
If you've read any of my chats on ESPN.com, pretty much anything that isn't related to basketball that I answer in those chats will probably come up in this podcast.
We're going to go out of our way not to talk about basketball, apparently.
That's, you know, it seems like I already talk about basketball a lot.
So anyway, I wanted to start out by looking at the previous week's Seahawks game against the Carolina Panthers. Since it's Seattle-centric, the Seahawks are obviously the thing that's compelled Seattle the most. And I was thinking that the most interesting way, since conversations about the Seahawks are so dominated throughout the entire week, is to look at Pro Football Reference and see if there's anything interesting that can be taken from that box score. So I was picking through it, and I thought that the most interesting thing that I saw in there, they break down passes short left, deep left, middle, and right. And the Panthers in that game, when they threw short left, were 12 of 13 for 62 yards and one touchdown. With Brendan Branner out, that was the side that, and they break it down really nicely there on Pro Football Reference, too. That was the side that Byron Maxwell was playing, and then also for linebacker, I'm pretty sure that was the Malcolm Smith, Mike Morgan side. And then on the right side, they were 2 for 7 for 25 yards and no touchdown, and that's the Richard Sherman side. And just want to talk about the Richard Sherman factor and how he basically shut down that entire side of the field, even though Sherman didn't really accumulate any stats in the game.
Yeah, and that's one of the things about cornerbacks is you really have to watch them play because statistics are not telling in this case because so much of the value of an elite cornerback is just taking his wide receiver out of the play entirely. That's one of the things that actually I took note of during the game is the fact that the Seahawks were not moving around Richard Sherman to stay with Steve Smith, Carolina's number one receiver. And it seemed like after early in the game, Field Goals, in one of their analyses of this week's game, pointed out that it was after Sherman nearly intercepted a pass on a crossing route that they sort of made the shift and put Steve Smith on the opposite side and just tried to say, nearly intercepted it. So that's when they started to go away from him, and you never saw Sherman as a factor at all because Cam Newton wasn't even looking his direction.
I heard him take credit for the fumble, though, the Earl Thomas fumble at the end of the game.
I mean, it was kind of a 50-50 thing. Earl Thomas officially got credit, but Sherman started the process.
So that's an interesting thing to think about. I know that we talked about the different sides, and during the game you were commenting about why Dan Quinn didn't move Sherman around based upon where Steve Smith is.
I mean, if I was a defensive coordinator, to me, it's a no-brainer to match up your number one cornerback with the number one wide receiver whenever possible. I mean, obviously, they're going to put guys in the slot. They're going to do things like that. You know, you're not going to be able to do it 100% of plays. But to me, as much as you can control that, I would.
Something about that feels like too obvious of an answer. I'm just, like, following Steve Smith around with Richard Sherman. And there has to be a reason. So I was thinking about this, that I think basically for the Seahawks in particular, having traditionally have Browner on one side and Sherman on the other side, where you have elite corners on both sides, it makes the most sense to have them be so proficient at that one side and used to playing there and with the way that you position your body. And having Browner on the other side is basically equally proficient. Just not having him for this game change things. But throughout the whole season, it makes the most sense to have your corners focus on one side rather than matching up with a specific player.
The other thing we saw in the game was that when the Seahawks went to their nickel packages, Walter Thurman moved inside, and then Byron Maxwell was playing out against wide receivers, which is where Browner will be, obviously, when he's healthy.
Do you think that's going to be a factor against the 49ers this week? I mean, they have Anquan Boldin as an option, Vernon Davis inside. We would assume that Brandon Browner is going to be coming back.
It still seems a little up in the air, but hopefully.
If he is coming back, obviously you wouldn't match up Sherman versus Boldin.
I mean, the other thing that Boldin we saw from him, and the nice thing about the schedule last weekend being as morning heavy as it was, sucked during that point, but we got to see a lot of the 49ers and the Packers, and it was basically Boldin sitting down in zones and finding these open spots. So that makes me wonder if the Seahawks will be playing a lot more man coverage and daring him and these other, you know, less proficient San Francisco receivers to beat them one-on-one.
Who's their third receiver? Kyle Williams and then John Boldin?
Yeah, I mean, they played a couple different guys. They have a mid-round pick this year.
I can't even remember who else got any targets. So you also want to talk about Doug Baldwin from that last game, because there's a big thing that popped up during the broadcast and then also on Pro Football Reference.
Well, that's what I wrote about this week on the blog. You actually, if you're listening to this on the After the Buzzer blog, I kind of forgot the name of my own blog.
Yeah.
You can scroll down and see my analysis of this, how in 2011, Doug Baldwin was one of the most valuable receivers in the NFL on third down, had almost identical statistics to Wes Welker in terms of targets, receptions, first downs, all of those things. Was very good at turning his receptions into first downs on third down. And then last year, we didn't see that from him. He was struggled with injuries, and the one thing he pointed out on the fifth quarter on his interview with Paul Sylvie and Warren Moon is that he was injured in training camp, didn't get a chance to work with Russell Wilson before Wilson got named the starter, and it took them a while to build that chemistry, and now it seems like they have it, and he's going to be a big third down weapon again.
So you'd expect that to continue throughout the year for Doug Baldwin, him being a third down target?
Yeah, I mean, teams will probably look for him a little bit more now that they've seen that four of the six completions the Seahawks had for first downs on third down went to Baldwin on Sunday. But, you know, he's very good in the slot, and that's a tough thing for opponents to stop.
Awesome. And I also want to talk about this field goals article that came out this week. Do you want to summarize that really quickly and we can talk about it?
Yeah, another good breakdown, field goals, a fine source of Seahawks information, had a look at the play that basically clinched the game where Marshawn Lynch ran for a first down, and that was a read option, one of the few that the Seahawks ran on Sunday. But what made it interesting is that Russell Wilson wasn't reading the defensive end is kind of traditional in the read option, so it's something we're starting to see more this year where quarterbacks are reading different players on the field. In this case, the Seahawks blocked the defensive end with Russell Okung and then relied on reading star Lotulelei, the defensive tackle rookie, who is first-round pick for Carolina this year. Very good, but perhaps not as experienced at dealing with the read option. And, you know, as defensive coordinators start to look at this, they're teaching their defensive ends, but are they teaching everybody on the field?
Yeah, I feel like that has to be the future of the read option. When it, like this summer, we were talking about the read option. The whole conversation about it was just like looking at those defensive ends and reading them in the more traditional way that it was run last year. But now the offensive coordinators who are running the read option, and I don't think that they're going to run it as much, but they're going to have time to look at reading different players along the line and reading especially a rookie defensive tackle like that. It's a pretty brilliant call, I thought, there by Darrell Bevell to seal the game.
Saved it for the right time, certainly. And then, you know, the next layer of that is we saw a lot from Philadelphia this week in the very exciting debut of Chip Kelly's offense with the Eagles of they're not only reading, do I hand off or do I keep? They're reading hand off, keep, or pass. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, another layer. At some point, it's just there's too many options for defenses to be able to stop everything.
Yeah, I think when people talk about it being like a passing fad, maybe they're talking more specifically about the traditional, like, reading that defensive end, but having all these different options. It's basically just opening up your playbook to having so many different options on the field every single play.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's something like the Wildcat, and it'll be interesting to see how much of what Chip Kelly is doing gets picked up by other teams. I mean, last year the Seahawks put this in midseason. San Francisco added it much more over the course of the season, you know, with Colin Kaepernick replacing Alex Smith. So it's going to be interesting to see how much these two teams run it on Sunday.
And then we also wanted to talk about Ron Rivera. I have to say, so this game, the game happened, Seahawks won 12-7, and we didn't dominate the Panthers, but in a lot of ways really beat them, like, outgained them by a significant amount. And I was wondering, I was like, why doesn't this feel like a better victory? Like, why are we coming out of this? And I determined that I think it's because it really felt like the Panthers could have done so much more. If Ron Rivera weren't their coach, if they were a little tiny bit more aggressive in the situations, basically every third down that they had, or every fourth down that they had, was 4th-and-2 or 3, and Ron Rivera elected to punt instead of going with his monstrous quarterback.
Well, I would say there was two MVPs for the Seahawks in the game, and one of them was Armand Smith, who had two penalties on punt coverage, one of them a really crucial one that turned around field position because of his inexplicable decision to run out of bounds and stay out of bounds one time with push, which Steve Smith took him to task for on the sidelines. And then the other would be Ron Rivera for his very conservative play calls. I mean, I understand it's a low-scoring game. You don't want to take a risk. But at some point, you have to put points on the board.
He lost that game for them, Ron Rivera.
The thing about the Carolina offense is it's basically designed to churn out 3 to 4 yards at a time. So you're going to get yourself in a lot of 4th-and-1 situations. And they're... Nobody in the league should be better at picking those up.
It's pretty crazy. If Chip Kelly would have been in those situations, they would have scored 40 points. Like, the ball would have been moving down the field so fast if Chip Kelly was there, and you would not even thought about those 4th downs. 4th-and-inches with Cam Newton as your quarterback, there's nothing to think about there.
And that was one good thing Bill Barnwell pointed out this week in his recap of the Eagles opener, was that by not even considering whether they're going to go for the 4th down or not, the Eagles are already at the line.
Oh, yeah.
They're able to set up personnel the way they want, and they're not, you know, looking at the coach and spending 20 seconds on the play clock trying to figure out what they want to do.
No, that's definitely like one of the most innovative things that Chip Kelly is doing, is that even if all these other coaches are sometimes maybe a little bit more starting to go for 4th downs, Chip Kelly is just doing it. There's no thought process behind it. It's like, if this is the situation, we're going to go for it. I think if Chip Kelly was the coach of the Panthers, I mean, my expectation for them this year, especially after that first game, is 7-9 at best. I mean, Ron Rivera is holding them back from three wins at least.
I mean, I think it could be 8-8, 9-7. I mean, at some point, their luck is bound to turn. Because, you know, for all Ron Rivera did, he's not the one who lost a fumble inside the 10 on the final drive.
It's true. There were other things, though, even aside from just not going for 4th downs, like them not throwing the ball downfield at all. Like, when you look on Pro Football Reference how many deep passes they had, I think that they had 2 deep passes the entire game. One was a completion to Greg Olsen, and I think one was an incompletion to Greg Olsen, which I think he dropped. It was just like, they're not even trying to stretch the field even remotely. There was no threat for the Seahawks on defense. So I think that's why it didn't feel like a better win. I mean, it's obviously always good to get a win on the road, especially in one of those grimy games. Getting to 1-0 and in week 1, too, is pretty spectacular. But it didn't feel right because it was just like, this team should have won the game. The Panthers should have beaten the Seahawks in week 1.
Well, in some ways, it's funny because Russell Wilson passed for, you know, 320 yards the most he's ever had in a regular season game, and it was a really pass-heavy offense. But despite that, in a lot of ways, it felt like, well, the Carolina game last year and a lot of the early season games for the Seahawks last year, where part of the reason they didn't score very many points is just because of the fact that it's such a defensive game that they didn't really have to open things up.
Well,
also
the lack of possessions. I think it was 9
yep.
for the Seahawks and 8 for the Panthers.
Very low possession.
And
game.
One of those possessions was an end-of-the-half possession for the Panthers.
The anti-Chip Kelly game.
So the Panthers basically had 7 possessions throughout the game, and when you aren't going for 4th-and-1s in that situation, you're screwing yourself for the entire game, basically.
And the other thing is they only had 1 3-and-out. That's part of why I think their offense felt more productive than ultimately it was on the scoreboard.
No, at one point during the game, you said, oh my god, the Panthers' offense is amazing. And I was like, it's unstoppable.
That is partially the pessimism of watching a game.
It just felt like, yeah, I agree. I was like, there is an this is an amazing offense we're watching. The Seahawks have no chance of stopping them. But they had scored 7 points at this point and didn't score again after that. It was just like they were moving the ball so easily until Ron Rivera stopped them. It was like having a 12th defensive player. It was really an impressive performance. I normally, for coaches who are on the hot seat, I feel I am always sympathetic towards coaches. Even the old Pat Shurmur. Even I was like, Pat Shurmur didn't get a fair shake.
You were alone on that one.
I know. But coaches who get fired, I always want to like be on the side of the coach. I don't really know why, except for Jim Moore, of course. But coaches who are getting fired, I always want to be on the side of them staying with their job. But Ron Rivera needs to be fired immediately.
I mean, if there was a way that they could demote him to defensive coordinator during the season, because he's really good at, like, coordinating stuff. He just should not be making overall game management decisions in any scenario.
Yeah, I don't know who decided to let him make their decisions about whether they're going to go for it on fourth down.
If they could, like, hire Bill Barnwell and delegate that to him.
Bill Barnwell. So anyway, I think that was it from the Seahawks game. Do we have any thoughts on going forward? Should we pick the 49ers game?
I hate picking games.
Okay,
so
perfect.
Do you
feel like the Seahawks are going to win? We don't have to pick points. No,
no,
you don't want to pick
that.
Okay, what about
incredibly nervous?
Okay. How about this? Percentages. What percent of the time do you think the Seahawks will win or lose on Sunday?
All right. I mean, it's probably more than 50%. I mean, what I just said.
Everything in life is 50-50.
I mean, I think that the line on the game is 3, which implies that it's basically an even matchup and the Seahawks have home field. I mean, I feel maybe a little bit more positive. Before the season, I felt the Seahawks were a better team. San Francisco maybe surprised me a little bit with how good their pass offense was in game 1, but I think that's probably a pretty fair assessment.
So what percentage of the time do you think the Seahawks win the game?
I mean, that's somewhere between 55 and 60. I don't know the exact amount.
I feel like it's 75%. I can conceive of scenarios where the 49ers win, and I don't want to do this being a homer because I don't think that's the case. I just think that this game is set up for the Seahawks to win it.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's either this or the San Francisco game last year is the most anticipated game in Seattle since, I mean, a non-playoff game probably ever. So,
all the factors. The crowd is going to be incredibly loose.
That's a synonym for drinking since 10 a.m.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. The crowd is going to be incredibly loose. We have experience dealing with a quarterback like Colin Kaepernick, the demolition that we put on them last year in December here at home. I can conceive, again, of scenarios where the 49ers win the game, but only about 25% of the time.
Those are all reasons to think that the Seahawks will be overconfident and that San Francisco will be extremely motivated to come back and play much better than they did last December at CenturyLink Field. So I'm just going to remain nervous.
Remain nervous. I thought that was going to happen with the Packers in this game after having the whole offseason to prepare. And the Packers, I mean, they were fine, but
they didn't lead in the fourth quarter.
It didn't play out the way that I expected it to
play out. I mean, don't you feel like, based on what happened in that game, like if we played that game 100 times, Green Bay at San Francisco, how many times do you think San Francisco would win that game?
I think they win it 60 times.
Okay, see, that's about how I feel about this week's game. So, I think that Green Bay, San Francisco, Seattle, all approximately the same level, and this is, by the way, why this game and the other matchup with San Francisco are so important, because they're the difference between having home field potentially throughout the NFC playoffs and having to go on the road the entire time.
Absolutely. You think that's it on the Seahawks?
I think so. I mean, I think we move forward to the fact that this Sunday's highly anticipated Seahawks game is part of a big sports weekend in Seattle. The first time all year that we'll have the Huskies, the Seahawks, and the Seattle Sounders, and the Storm, all in action this weekend.
It's pretty amazing. I'm going to be at CenturyLink Field twice over the weekend, both for, I think the Sounders might be expecting to sell out that game.
Well, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 60,000, I think, already. It's one of the 4-game package that they put together that conveniently included the Portland game that turned out to be Clint Dempsey's debut, so they sold a ton of tickets with that. Still tickets available, as we were able to get some this week. But
and you said that it's going to be the first match where Martins,
Potentially.
Martins, Johnson, and Dempsey all play together?
They haven't played together yet, as far as I know. And obviously, Dempsey and Johnson are both coming back from playing with the national team this week and helping the U.S. secure a World Cup spot.
Did Johnson start for the national team?
He did.
On Tuesday?
Because Altidore was out and ended up scoring the first goal. Dempsey missed the penalty kick at the end of the game, which was awesome because it preserved Dos Acero, the fourth time that the U.S. has beaten Mexico 2-0.
Dempsey
including
missed the penalty kick?
Yeah, apparently he's bad at penalty kicks.
Why was he taking it?
He did on Friday in the previous game and hit it.
Huh. Interesting. I did not know that. So anyway, you watched most of the Illinois game. So Illinois last week, who are the Huskies' opponent coming up this Saturday at Soldier Field. And you watched last week Illinois and their quarterback Nathan Shielhass playing against Cincinnati. And really, they kind of destroyed Cincinnati in that game.
They were unexpectedly good. I think they were like two touchdown, or they were at least a touchdown underdogs in that game, and ended up just completely dominating Cincinnati, and eventually Cincinnati's star quarterback probably blew out his ACL. I don't know about that now, but it was pretty bad. Anyway, you know,
his name is also Munchie.
That's a nickname, but okay. Yeah, it seemed like he would fit well at Washington, actually, but. You know, what was interesting was how good the Illinois offense was. And Shielhass, obviously a very talented dual-threat quarterback, that buzzword these days. But they were running an offense that in many ways reminded me a lot of what the Huskies do. You know, besides the hurry-up, the up-tempo offense that is getting put in this season by Steve Sarkisian, what we've seen in the past and saw again in the opener against Boise State is a lot of using different formations, using motion and things like that to create mismatches, and that's exactly what Illinois did very successfully.
Did they? I only saw about 5 minutes of it. I was watching one of the other games. But I know that the Seahawks, or the Huskies, are going to try to use Jadon Mickens in a lot of motion. And you felt like he was the player of the game from the Boise State game a few weeks ago.
Yeah, you know, I haven't gone through. I charted the plays on which they used the fly action when I went through and watched that game. It turned out maybe that wasn't as effective as I thought it was. It was more about just getting Mickens on the edge and using his speed. You know, he is a very fast player who last year, you know, he's talked about kind of the game was too fast for him, and now he's not thinking, he's just playing, and, you know, ended up being a very useful receiver out on the edge. So I think what you see with UW offense is just the number of options. First, you've got Bishop Sankey and that kind of power run game that was so good at the end of last season and good against Boise State. Then you've got Mickens and Ross on the edge. Kaysen Williams is a possession receiver or a deep threat. And now you add in ASJ coming back for this game is kind of that underneath guy. And, you know, this offense could be really tough to stop.
It's a spectacular amount of weapons. The thing that concerns me, I suppose, is how easily Illinois was moving the ball last Saturday. And I thought our defense looked pretty amazing against Boise State, but do you think, how will the defense's performance against Illinois inform your perspective of them going forward?
Well, you know, I think that first off, one thing that may be key is Boise State was able to move the ball really well between the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened time and time again is they got into the red zone and that field shortened up. You know, no longer do you have to honor the deep threat, even though Boise State almost never went deep.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you know, UW was able to contain them much more. And I think we may see something similar this week with Illinois. I think that's one of the things that I think was good about the Washington offense, similar style where you're using a lot of short, quick passes to the outside, but they were still able to make plays in the red zone. They stretched the field more vertically at that point with Kaysen Williams had that touchdown pass and the Josh Perkins touchdown when Keith Price scrambled. So that's the thing we're watching.
But we should also assume having ASJ back is a huge red zone threat also.
Yeah, I mean, Illinois doesn't have anyone like that. So, you know, I think my expectations in general going into this game, I anticipate a much more competitive game than I was thinking before watching Illinois last week.
Absolutely.
When you were just looking at a 2-10 team.
I mean,
UW should be favored and probably should win.
But going into that, I was looking at the schedule after the Boise State win, and I was like, I feel like we should go into Stanford undefeated. And so that's at Illinois, hosting Idaho State, hosting Arizona, and then going at Stanford.
Yeah, I mean, Arizona is obviously a difficult game. Destroyed the Huskies in Tucson last year, and, you know, the kind of up-tempo offense that has been very difficult for the Huskies in the past, but we'll see how much playing that kind of offense in practice every day will help. But, you know, that's definitely a realistic possibility at this point.
Well, I feel like after watching even that little bit of Illinois versus Cincinnati, my perspective has changed. Also, your scouting and sample tweets for Coach Sark have changed my perspective on that one. But Illinois looked really good, so it's going to be an interesting game going forward. And I feel like it will inform how we view the entire season for the Huskies, because Illinois is kind of sneaky good now at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think Football Outsiders made a good point in previewing this weekend that, like, we don't know whatever happens this weekend. We don't know what it means, because the Huskies were so much better than expected against Boise State, and Illinois was so much better than expected against Cincinnati. So nobody knows how good either of these teams are, and it'll probably take those upcoming games, the, you know, the Arizonas, the Stanfords, before we figure out what it means.
But most importantly, we'll talk more about the Huskies probably next week after the game when we have something to look at. They had the bye week the previous week. Most importantly, I want to talk about tailgating for this weekend.
Big tailgating weekend.
It is. It's a big tailgating weekend. So last year, this is for the Seahawks game on Sunday, it's going to be an extended tailgate because we're playing the night game. Last year we had two different times we had that happen. It was the Packers on Monday night at the beginning of the season when it was sunny and nice out, and then the 49ers at the end of the season, which we talked about. Those were some pretty epic tailgates. You came down, we don't have Seahawks tickets, but you came down to the Packers tailgate and tailgated with us. It was a real party down there, including lots of people and lots of homeless people.
Oh, yeah. That's what the Third Avenue alley is going to be like, you know. You never know who you're going to see there. And, yeah, it was a good time.
It's going to be, we're looking right now at 6 hours of drinking, basically, from beginning to end. I want to go into the game earlier than we have. I'm thinking of going at 4:30 or so. So it's going to be a little bit shortened, but still getting down there as if it was a 1 o'clock game, and then just hanging out through the entire duration of the 1 o'clock games, and then going in for the night game.
I mean, it's such an important game that you have to prepare yourself, of course.
Oh, absolutely. So some ground rules for tailgating, and how we see tailgating making sense, and what beer you should be drinking. And I feel like beer is the perfect tailgating drink. Liquor should be reserved for other situations. But beer and football mix together so well that it puts you in the right mood.
Did it put you in the right mood for the Boise State game?
It really did. I was in, I suppose, the right mood. Not the right mood to remember the Boise State game, but I feel like I cheered loud enough.
Yeah.
So the ground rules that I think we both agree on is, for the beginning part of the day, you should be drinking your micro brews. Something ideally local. I consider local Seattle, Portland, to Vancouver if they had microbrews. So it's ideally something, I guess, going all the way to the end of Oregon, because I want to include Ninkasi in there from Eugene.
I mean, what about Sierra Nevada? Is that acceptable here?
I'm considering that local also.
If you like them, and they're on the West Coast.
My definition of local stretches as far as I like, but has to be on the West Coast. But so drinking.
Wait, what about Alaskan? Is that local?
Man, that's
I mean, they're part of the Pacific Northwest. They're Seahawks territory.
Absolutely. Alaskan is absolutely local.
All right.
So local stretches from Alaska to Northern California.
Yeah, okay.
That feels like that. To the Sierra Nevada. So anyway, drinking something, trying to get to the point here, drinking something which is nicer for your first beers, and then after you've been loosened up a little bit, you have to move to the Rainier. Right?
Yeah.
So you drink the Rainier.
That's hyper-local.
It's hyper-local, actually. It's technically not anymore.
But in spirit, it's hyper-local.
Culturally, it's hyper-local.
We live just south of Georgetown, within probably 10 minutes of the brewery where it originally was brewed.
If only Georgetown Brewing bottled their beer. If we could drink Manny's for the first beers of the day, I feel like that would be perfect.
There was something I saw that was bottled that I had never seen bottled before. I think it might have been like a Rogue six-pack.
A Rogue, they have those. Rogue Dead Guy, they have six packs of those. They do Dead Guy and Mocha Porter in six packs. So do you have any recommendations? So I think it's still going to be sunny this weekend.
Yeah, it is.
Should we be trying to milk the summer beer for one more weekend?
Now, first off, this is a topic near and dear to my heart. A key thing that I have pointed out on social media is I hate fall beer creep.
especially because in Seattle, fall...
Do you just hate fall beer creep, or do you hate any beer creep?
I generally hate beer creep, but fall beer creep is by far the worst.
Do you hate beer creeps, too?
Well,
I got some of those.
Oh, really? Are any of them part of the tailgate? Because the fall is so depressing weather-wise in Seattle after September when it's still... I mean, it's 80 degrees outside when we're recording this, but... You know, the looming gray and rain, I want to try to put that as far from my mind as possible. And that's why I think it's important to stick with the summer beer until it's time, until the weather requires you to switch over to fall beers.
I understand, I agree with you. But fall beers are so good.
But summer beers are so good.
They're
light and flavorful.
What I'm thinking is, I'm thinking Alaskan summer. I don't think I've had any of that. We've been drinking the Widmer Citra.
We've been going
pretty hard on the Widmer Citra.
A fair amount of the Twilight from Deschutes.
Yep. And so I'm thinking that Alaskan summer, being local, now that we've established the local ground rules, it being local, I'm thinking that that's what we should drink in the beginning part of the tailgate, before, of course, moving to Rainier. Other, I suppose, reasonable replacements for Rainier, if you're in a pinch, would be Olympia, and then your PBR and things like that.
I feel like Coors Light is acceptable at football because it's the official drink of football.
I'm just not interested in Coors Light.
I mean, that's fair.
I feel like I've moved beyond Coors Light.
Your palate is too refined now.
Miller High Life is another one that could be a replacement. My palate is too refined. I really feel like if you're drinking Coors Light, you're just drinking and then you're going to be peeing. That's it. That's all that happens with Coors Light. It's not even like drinking beer. It's like you're hydrating yourself.
Sometimes it's refreshing, though. I mean, there's certain circumstances.
I do agree that it can be refreshing. Have you tried this Red Hook Audible Ale?
No, I see it in the stores, and I'm always intrigued by it.
It's linked with Dan Patrick, which I feel like makes me uncomfortable.
I can't comment on that.
Well, Red Hook is a local brewery, right? They're in Issaquah? Woodinville.
I think Issaquah. Woodinville. Yeah, you're right.
Red Hook is a local brewery. I feel like they should have paired with some sort of, it's like a football ale, with some sort of local football name.
John Clayton?
John Clayton. John Clayton.
When I think John Clayton, I think
Red Hook Audible Ale. I was thinking like Brock Heward. I don't know. I don't know who it could be. John Clayton.
Warren Moon?
Warren Moon. Not Sonny Sixkiller. He'd yell at us. I think that I had one of the Audible Ales at the halftime of the Boise State Husky game, but I have no recollection of this. It was, it may have been good. I know that I drank it quickly. But our seats are right next to the zone. You can see the zone, which is where you can go get food and drinks at halftime of the Husky game, from our seats in the East End zone. So I was sitting there staring at all these people, and I was like, well, I need to be over there at halftime. And so I got whatever and drank it as quickly as possible.
I mean, we're going to need a more elaborate review later on the podcast in a future episode.
Of the Red Hook Audible Ale.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious about it.
If you're listening at home and you have any suggestions specifically for fall beers, you can send them to Kevin's Twitter, at Cape Helton.
Yes.
He's always welcoming beer suggestions.
The one I am excited about when we do make the fall beer switch, as much as I'm putting that off, is Sierra Nevada Tumbler, which I thought was really good last year.
Absolutely. Sierra Nevada, I think it's weird that people talk about beers on like a yearly basis, because it tastes the same to me. Can you taste the difference on a type of beer from year to year?
No. I mean, how would I even remember
it? Exactly. My palate and my memory are not that refined.
Yeah.
But Sierra Nevada, I know that people do talk about it that way. And I was like, you're just making this up. You're just pretending like you remember the previous year. Because no one does.
Well, it's just the first time I ever had Tumbler was last year. That's why I said last year.
It's a spectacular fall beer, though.
Yeah, well, it's a very good one. I mean, I enjoy a good pumpkin ale.
I don't think I like the pumpkin ale.
You can't, like, that's not one you can drink for, like, a great deal of volume. But if you're having one beer, one off, like, you know...
I had this beer, it's called Pumpking. It's from some brewery in, I think, Boston. It's like a highly, highly reviewed ale. It's called Pumpking. It is so intense, it was undrinkable. It was like actually drinking a pumpkin.
More intense than the maple bacon voodoo donut.
I think the maple bacon was a little bit, it was a little bit drinkable.
It wasn't that bad, but the aftertaste.
I wanted to die when I drank the pumpkin. It's so highly reviewed, too. And I think it ruined all pumpkin beer for me.
Well, I think you're going to have to give it another chance. It's been a full year now.
Maybe if we have a tailgate right around Halloween, I could see I could see drinking one of the pumpkin beers at that. Maybe like a 24-ounce, a couple of 24-ounces instead of a 6-pack of 12-ounces.
Yeah, and you can share those.
But I also wanted to ask you, so I'm obsessed with the idea of perfecting, not just doing it, perfecting.
If you're going to do something, you have to perfect it.
Absolutely. The Juicy Lucy burger. And so that's the burger where you would bake it, you're not baking anything. You would have two patties with the cheese right in the middle. And so we tried this out a couple times before, and I think the biggest mistake and the most feedback that I've gotten for improving it is that I used too nice cheese. We were using the Tillamook cheddar, I think Tillamook sharp cheddar, and the feedback seems to be that you need to use just American cheese, Kraft singles.
Well, it's all about the melting point, and it's awfully high in like the Tillamook, and it doesn't really get gooey, which is what you really ideally want with a Juicy Lucy. Is it's just like kind of oozing cheese out when you eat. And I know that doesn't really sound appealing, but it's delicious.
Now, oozing cheese, I mean, the word oozing doesn't sound that great, but oozing cheese sounds amazing.
It sounds better than anything else you could be oozing.
You could also do it with the American cheese on the inside and Tillamook cheddar on the top.
I think that's, yeah, you get the two different flavors.
Then you're having to buy two different types of cheese.
Well, my big concern was the fact that it was pretty pink on the inside because it's tough to cook that sufficiently long to really get everything inside.
So that's my question for you. Should I try to barbecue that this weekend? Now, keep in mind that we'll probably barbecue around 2 o'clock, and I will have been drinking from 10 a.m. until 2 o'clock.
That seems like problem number one. See, the big problem to me is the concern about food poisoning based on the undercooking.
Also,
you don't want to be in a stadium for the next 3 hours.
It's true, the line
hours.
In the bathroom. Man, you're bringing up some valid points here.
I always
there
do.
There are incredible lines at CenturyLink Field.
Or you know, if it's during the game, you don't want to be missing the game because you're feeling indigestion. So I
don't think indigestion is what I'm worried about.
I try to minimize my chance of food poisoning as much as possible before heading to football games. That's just how I roll.
So are you saying you're advising against cooking the Juicy Lucy burger this weekend?
I think it's better to do it at home. And
at
if
home?
You perfect it, then you take it maybe to the tailgate.
Oh, so perfect it at home and then ooze it onto the public.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't like cook burgers for the first time at a tailgate. You had done it before at home. And then
you cooked burgers for the first time at a tailgate.
Yeah. But you haven't seen enough burgers cooked.
Here's another question. When you spell Juicy Lucy, do you spell it with the I or just J-U-C-Y?
Well, if you know, I'm so grammatically, strict that obviously I stick with the I.
You stick with the I?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's how the word juicy is spelled.
But
the notorious B.I.G. song is not J-U-C-Y.
It's not branded as, it's part of the Juicy Lucy brand. That's why it's spelled differently. The word juicy doesn't really matter.
But there's a debate about this between the two taverns in Minneapolis that claim to have invented it. One spells it with the I and one doesn't.
I know, and I'm pretty sure that I side with the one who doesn't spell it with the I.
I side with the one who spells it with the I.
Well, I'm happy we can disagree on something.
Does make for better podcast, doesn't it?
Do we have anything else about tailgating? There's more, but I feel like it's sickening talking more about undercooked burgers.
It's not real appetizing. I mean, it's a long season. We're going to have plenty of time to talk about tailgating.
I agree. By the end of the season, I want to have perfected the Juicy Lucy burger. So much so that people travel from miles around to our tailgate and ask for the Juicy Lucy burger.
That seems improbable.
Well, yeah.
It's important to have goals.
Pretty much everybody who's traveling with the CX game is coming from miles around.
That's valid.
But it's something that I want to, I don't remember what we play, week 16 or 17 at home. By one of those weeks, the playoffs at home, in fact, I want to have
that's me knocking on wood, in case you couldn't tell.
The Juicy Lucy burger perfected.
All right, well, should we talk about fantasy to close things up?
Absolutely. So, a little bit of background on Kevin here and myself and fantasy football. We're in a league together. We've been in the league for, I believe, we've finished 6 seasons. And I have been the league's champion 4 of those seasons.
I have been the league champion 0 of those seasons.
It's true. He has had Brandon Lloyd an incredible amount of time. And also Kyle Orton.
I feel like you're mostly just those couple seasons when they were united in Denver and it was a joyous pairing until that.
If
evil
were,
Tim Tebow interfered.
If they were ever reunited and it feels so good, you would have Brandon Lloyd and Kyle Orton.
I mean, if Kyle Orton becomes the Cowboys starting quarterback because Tony Romo suffers a rib injury in all likelihood, you know, should that happen, they have to sign Brandon Lloyd. He would be their number three receiver.
But you can lose in fantasy football. Just for you to go into the last week with a chance to make the playoffs and then lose.
That's, and lose to Ridgeway.
So that's what you have to look forward to.
That should be terrific.
So at some point, I started considering myself a fantasy expert. in fact,
self-proclaimed.
And I also was part of another league with another group of people. Our group is mostly from the greater South Seattle area. One of them just moved to Texas, so now we've
expanded our geographic reach considerably.
Yeah, that's important. When you think of a fantasy league, you want to be spread throughout the country. And I was also in another league, which I absolutely dominated. So I've gone through seven fantasy seasons and won five championships. An impressive amount. This year, my team is easily the best team. I scored the most points of anybody last week.
Would you call it a juggernaut?
I don't want to use the word juggernaut, but I've already started etching my name onto the Coors Light.
Oh, wow.
The Coors Light Silver Bullet Boss Award, which is what we're all planning for.
This is one of the most impressive self-jinx efforts I've ever seen.
Self-jinx efforts? My team is just that good.
During the draft, I mean, like, by the 9th or 10th round, I realized that you were going to die. As soon as you got Jordy Nelson, I think, in, like, the 9th round.
I didn't start Reggie Wayne last week. Reggie Wayne was started in, like, 98% of leagues. That might have been my own stupidity because I started Lamar Miller. But I didn't start Reggie Wayne last week. After that, it's pretty ugly, though, I have to say. I'm not that excited about my depth. So anyway, I'm a fantasy expert. I'm Kevin here.
No, he's a fantasy player.
A fantasy participant.
I got a ribbon for participating.
You've made the playoffs a couple times. That was nice.
Several times. I was in the finals at least once, maybe twice, right?
I don't think you've played me in the finals,
have you? Yeah, I only played Katie in the finals.
Yeah, well. So anyway, that's a little bit of background on our fantasy knowledge. Don't listen to anything that he has to say. But so do we have any observations from week one of fantasy football?
Well, I think the really interesting thing that happened during week one was the fact that a lot of the dominant first-round running backs that we expected to be, you know, stars really struggled. And I saw this certainly in my matchup firsthand. I had Marshawn Lynch and Stephen Ridley are my two first picks.
Okay.
And Lynch had, you know, an off day. I think it was just the Seattle offensive line against the Carolina's defensive line. I'm not really worried about him. But Ridley, of course, fumbled and got benched the rest of the game. And then I ended up winning because on the other side, my opponent had David Wilson, who fumbled twice and ended up with a negative. And, like, the wildly optimistic scenario is I was calculating, how can I come back? It turned out David Wilson did get a negative, and Victor Cruz did get 29 points. So somehow that happened.
Pretty spectacular. I had written you off completely. But I was thinking before the draft that there's not really any difference. I mean, there's only slight differences between the top running back consensus, which is Adrian Peterson, and maybe the 12th running back or so, which was Alfred Morris, Trent Richardson, LeSean McCoy, something in that range, how they're being drafted, which kind of turned out to be true because a lot of those running backs were terrible.
Oh, they were equally bad.
Adrian Peterson had the 3 touchdowns, but didn't even feel like he played that well except for the 78-yard touchdown.
I'm not that worried about him.
I'm not worried about Adrian Peterson either. So I wanted to look at this and talk about the fantasy running backs who had kind of rough weeks in week one and see what you think the chances are percentage-wise of them being a top 10 running back this year.
Okay.
So some players who were probably in there, maybe kind of on the cusp. And I want to start with Stephen Ridley since you own him. And he had a pretty impressively terrible game.
I mean, he did have 9 carries for 46 yards. He fumbled once, nearly fumbled a second time, and then got benched for the rest of the game. Partially because Shane Vereen played really well. But now Shane Vereen had surgery. He's out until at least week 10 because of the IR that they've put him on. They can take him off, but not, I think, until week 11, as I understand it. So now his competition is LeGarrette Blount.
Yeah.
And, the Bolden guy.
Oh, Brandon Bolden.
Brandon Bolden. And so it's a little bit easier for... I'm going to start him tonight, in fact, against the Jets. And I feel like there's at least a 1 in 3 chance he's a top 10.
I think there's 50% chance that Stephen Ridley is. Before the brain injury, I would say it was probably 25.
I still, for some reason, believe in Stephen Ridley. I believe in you, Stephen Ridley.
He did average over 5 yards a carry.
He is
also playing for the Patriots. It's just a question of whether he can stay on the field.
He's the one from this list that I'm least nervous about.
That's fair.
So next is Alfred Morris, who also fumbled, scored a touchdown.
And dropped a pitch in the end zone for a safety,
yeah.
Which it was pretty clearly his fault. It wasn't
Alfred Morris started out that game just terrible. I was kind of shocked. And then by the end of the game, Roy Helu was playing a lot of snaps. So it's still deep in that Washington backfield. I remember a year ago we went into it not knowing who the Redskins running back was going to be, and Alfred Morris clearly took that job over. But after week one, it's just like, what happened to Alfred Morris?
So Bill Barnwell and Robert Mays were talking about this on their podcast yesterday, and they noted that Helu is the up-tempo back for the Redskins. So presumably they're not going to fall behind by four touchdowns on a regular basis. Hopefully not. And, you know, I think that just the chemistry between RG3 and Alfred Morris wasn't there in part because they probably haven't played practiced together that much during training camp, didn't have a preseason game. So I would say that I'm less worried about Alfred Morris than I think you are.
I'd be pretty worried if I was an Alfred Morris owner.
I think there's at least a 50% chance he's a top 10.
Oh, I'd put it at 30%. I'm worried about the Roy Helu creep.
There's a lot of creep on this one.
You know I hate the Roy Helu creep. Okay, so here's another one. I own this person. It started last week. He scored a zero, had 10 carries for 3 yards.
That's bad.
And also lost out on playing time to Daniel Thomas.
That's Lamar Miller, since you didn't actually say who it was.
And that is Lamar Miller.
I actually thought I had Lamar Miller most of Sunday's first half until I realized that you actually had him, because we both wanted him as a Football Outsider's favorite Kubiak star going into
that.
The draft. Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for that, Kubiak.
I'll let you have that one. He might just not be very good. So there's a chance of that.
That's the thing. All the other running backs, like Stephen Ridley had a monster season last year. Alfred Morris was like third in rushing last year. Lamar Miller has never played well in his entire career.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say right now, like, 10% chance that he's a top 10 back. That might be optimistic.
I think that I'm on the fence about whether I'm going to start him this week. I'm actually debating between Lamar Miller and Reggie Wayne, which I know sounds insane.
That does sound insane. I mean, I do think the Cleveland defense is really good.
I think the Cleveland defense is awesome. So I don't... But the fact that he lost carries to Daniel Thomas at the end of the game was what really scared me, and I feel like Daniel Thomas was written off completely, and now it's like they're basically in a timeshare.
I mean, I think, didn't people like Daniel Thomas at one point? Which
I had him last year.
Okay, well, then maybe you've learned your lesson about Thomas
running back. Okay, and the last one is David Wilson, obviously fumbled twice, was benched. I think he might have started crying on the sideline.
It wasn't good. His body language was not strong.
And there's the quote from Tom Coughlin about how David Wilson is a marked man, and that's what I was saying to you earlier in the week,
yep.
Is that every single time David Wilson carries the ball, every single player who's tackling him is going to try to strip him.
It's a vicious cycle. Almost a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways.
We called it a self-fulfilling vicious cycle.
Yeah, I think that's the term we coined. That's a thing now.
Yeah.
But he's probably a good player. We're not sure about that, but I would say 20 to 25% chance. I mean, they signed Brandon Jacobs. Like, we know Brandon Jacobs can't play anymore. And their third string running back,
Darrell Scott.
Yeah, who you briefly claimed and then waived. I guess that'll come up later. But
he is also injured.
Yeah, he got hurt this week. So, and also may have been culpable on the interception that blew the game. Unclear on that one, but. Yeah, not a great day for him. He had a couple nice runs.
So for David Wilson, you feel like it's mostly mental. If he does play and can get past that.
Well, if he can do the Tiki Barber thing.
I feel like it takes years to do the Tiki Barber thing.
I don't know. Wasn't it like 1 year where Tiki Barber just learned to stop fumbling?
Do you think it was after
carrying the football around all the time?
Total breakdown in week one?
I mean, obviously there had to be an injury. I don't remember the exact Tiki Barber story anymore. But the Giants have done it before, so.
Okay, so what do you think about the chances for David Wilson being a top 10 running back?
I'd say 20%, 25%,
something. I think it's higher than that. After Darrell Scott was hurt, Andre Brown was somebody who I drafted and would be a monster fantasy play right now if he hadn't gotten hurt.
Yeah.
It's really terrible that he got hurt because he would be huge right now. Because David Wilson would be in Antarctica if Andre Brown was around. I think it's higher, though. I think that David Wilson is a good player. I think he's got a 40% chance of being a top 10 running back.
Oh, that's kind of optimistic.
And then I guess to close things out, do you want to talk about the waiver claims from this week?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously week one is the most interesting waiver claim. So I had in claims on, I think, four players. I had three claims in with the same player with Jordan Cameron, Thomas.
Julius Thomas.
Julius Thomas from Denver. He was my number one, then Cameron, and then number four was Julian Edelman.
Lost basically all of those.
I did. Yeah. So my number three waiver claim was the one I ended up getting, which was the Baltimore defense. So I know you had a waiver claim.
Thank you for that. Because I was feeling really high with the Baltimore defense. I was like, I've got this Baltimore defense. You're gonna get
nope.
You stole my defense. And it made me, and then I signed Darrell Scott, who was just like, all right, whatever, we'll throw that out there. And then I dropped him immediately when I didn't get the Baltimore defense and signed the Eagles defense, because I think the Eagles are looking a little bit spry.
That's an interesting one. They're going to be on the field a lot, so they could give up a lot of points because of that.
They're also playing against Phillip Rivers.
Well, he did not, you know, he had a
Phillip Rivers
staff.
Could become petulant at any point and start throwing the ball to them.
You can't rule it out.
I had claims in for Julian Edelman, did not get that. I was just maybe counting on other people not having claims in for people. I had the Ravens as number one, though, because I was like, that is the only one that I care about. And then it was your fourth claim.
It was my third.
Your third claim, and you got it.
Yeah.
You jerk.
Because I didn't get my first two claims.
And then,
first off, I learned my lesson last year after the RG3 debacle that you have to put a claim in on everyone and not assume that other people ahead of you are going to put in claims.
True. Was that RG3 that was the debacle then?
Wasn't it?
No, I don't think it was RG3.
Oh, it was Alfred Morris.
Alfred Morris.
And it was Alfred Morris.
And I got Alfred Morris. He was good.
And yeah, then you know what I'm saying?
I also claimed Greg Zuerlein just because Adam Vinatieri is a terrible kicker. But then the people who were dropped, I thought this was crazy. Eric Decker got dropped.
You did?
I mean, he had a bad game, but he didn't have that bad of a game. And also, I think he's a little bit injured, but Wes Welker is also a little bit injured. If Wes Welker goes down, Eric Decker is like a top 15 wide receiver.
I mean, I think that Decker is a better bet going forward than Julius Thomas. I mean, obviously, the fact he's got tight end eligibility is big, but...
I thought that was crazy, so now you know that I have a claim for Eric Decker, which you'll probably get him over me. But then also Vic Ballard, who is a starting running back, also got dropped. I thought Katie dropped him, because Katie always makes one stupid move. Our cousin, who's in the league with us, always makes one stupid move. You have a higher waiver. I'm 10th in waiver claim.
This means I have to decide whether someone else is going to claim these
guys. So I also put in a claim for Vic Ballard.
I obviously have claims in for both players. I have to decide my priority.
It was a starting running back who got dropped. I thought that was insane. I
mean, after running for 15 times for 63 yards on Sunday, it was a good game.
He's the perfect player to have on your bench.
Yeah.
And could eventually bump up to be a starter. I also thought it was interesting, though, if you can go back over there. So I was thinking that there weren't many great waiver claims this week, honestly. Like, there was nobody who stood out as having an amazing week. There were some tight ends, but I'm not really that excited about... I have Jimmy Graham, so I don't need Jordan Cameron. I don't need...
See, I'm a little on the fence about Antonio Gates, so that's why I definitely
wanted
to get...
No, you do need Julius Thomas.
Oh, thanks. Well, I didn't get him.
You would be better off having one of those guys.
Yeah, he would make a bigger difference
for me than
for
you.
You.
He had some catches.
I thought about Brent Celek.
Brent Celek might be interesting also. I feel like I'd take almost any of those guys over Antonio Gates. But so I was looking forward.
Antonio Gates was a foot away from a touchdown in a 10-point game.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
You don't know.
I don't know. The difference between Brent Celek and Antonio Gates is not that great.
At some point, you're splitting hairs.
But I was looking forward to this Kansas City defense who I played in week one. They are the top defense, and they have this stretch in week five through eight. So in week five, they play at Tennessee, and then week six through eight, they host Oakland, Houston, and Cleveland. That is such an incredibly easy stretch. Kansas City looks like a pretty damn good defense. So I need to keep...
They've always had a lot of individual stars on that, so
I think that
they
put... I mean, they were playing against Blaine Gabbert. But I think that they have put it together. And I was like, I need to project out, because this is one of those weeks where you had the ability to project out. I put in our notes that you don't do that because you're not smart enough. You're 15-10 on the SATs and then nothing for projecting fantasy 2 or 3 weeks out.
I don't even know how to read a schedule.
But this felt like a perfect week to be able to do that.
I mean, the downside is obviously you can't carry as many project running backs. Like, you know, I've got Josh Gordon on my bench who's not contributing anything, but who knows, maybe when he comes back, then the Cleveland offense clicks into gear and Brandon Whedon turns it around. You never know.
I think Josh Gordon's good.
He is.
Anything else about waiver claims?
I guess we will see what happens with... people listen to this and put in waiver claims. Obvious players, they should.
If KD reclaims Vic Ballard.
Well, she can't get him ahead of me. If I
okay, she could get Eric Decker.
She can get one of those too.
I have no chance of getting any of those players, but I had to put in claims to them. If you also have fantasy football questions and want to ask Alan's Twitter, he is.
I mean, you should probably ask him, but I can like relay
We'll talk about them on the podcast.
That's true. Yeah, you could send in questions for the next podcast. That seems like a fun thing to do.
And that's twitter.com/KPelton. They say at KPelton in the Twitterverse.
They do. We do. I would say I'm part of it.
You do. So that pretty much wraps it up.
I think so. Not bad for our first one.
No, I think it's pretty close.
So hopefully you enjoyed listening to it. If you made it all the way through this, I applaud you and commend you. Thanks.
We will be back next Wednesday.
Or Thursday or Friday, one of those days.
We'll be back a day in the week.
Yeah, okay. Look for it then.
Bye.